Icon Art Radio.
This is Icon Art Radio with Bill Teeple, that's me, and Alan Cobb and Donna Colby. Donna brought in some quotes from Picasso and a few other people, such as Van Gogh. And she has one juicy one of Picasso's that I said, let's do that one. So read that out and let's see where we go with that.
Okay. He said, and this quote, this was from the mid-1930s, somewhere around in there. He said, everybody wants to understand painting. Why is there no attempt to understand the song of birds? Why does one love a night, a flower, everything that surrounds a man without trying to understand it all? While as for painting, one wants to understand. Let it be understood, above all, that the artist works by necessity, that he too, a least element of the world, to which no more importance should be attached than to so many natural things which charm us, but which we do not explain to ourselves. Those who try to explain a picture are most of the time on the wrong track.
Well, one of the things that I deal with as a teacher is placing someone, a viewer, in front of a beautiful work of art, such as a Rothko or a Jackson Pollock, who we stirred the air the other night at Icon Video Night with Jackson Pollock's life. Wasn't quite sure the effect that had on everyone, but it's because there's this thing about standing in front of a painting that seems to be different about standing in front of a flower or a beautiful rock with lovely little all these different colors and shapes and all this charming stuff. You don't have to analyze why it's valuable to look at the rock. You just know that this is a really cool thing. I'm on a hike in the woods and I've picked up a rock and I'm turned on by this rock. And that's the way a person should stand in front of a Rothko or a Jackson Pollock or any work of abstract art or any painting at all. You should just enjoy it like music. I mean, music, it's easier. You don't really have to. I mean, people do have problems. They feel like they have to understand music, and those people are in trouble, because if they either understand the structure and all of this because they're a musician, but still it's the totality of how it's moving them that's important. But in any case, when I'm listening to music, I have these sonic forms washing over my being, and I'm just moved by it. But painting seemed to be even more problematic. You stand there and people start feeling like they can't look at it unless they understand it. And they don't understand it, and there's something inside that's saying, this is not a painting. I mean, it's just like the intellect gets really way too involved. What do you say about all this, Alan?
Oh, I was just nodding off. I agree. I think what it comes down to is the way in which we do our looking. And as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, on the one hand, the difference between looking at a Jackson Pollock painting and looking at a really cool rock that I found on the way up the mountain is that the Jackson Pollock painting is in a shrine. And the rock is in nature, and I chose to separate the rock from its environment, either just by visually, creeping up on it and staring at it, or by picking it up and holding it in my hand. So I think people have a tendency to, respond to that shrine notion of the gallery itself in different ways, and some people feel that, well, if it's enshrined, then it's bloody important. And if I don't know why it's important, I'm kind of an idiot and I'm missing something really critical here. And I'm obviously, not one of the people this was intended for, because I don't know why you would enshrine something that looks like a rug that someone made or looks like a, a drop cloth in the case of, a naive glance at a at a Pollock. But, you know, by the same token, I think if you could say to that person, have you ever walked up a mountain and noticed a really stunningly interesting bit of moss on a rock? And if they hopefully can say yes to that, then you could say, well, then forget the gallery or the museum and just look at this painting the same way. Look at it as though someone just said, hey, wait a minute, there's something here that you might not notice at first. And then they look at it that way instead of looking at it, you know, like they've tiptoed into someone else's area and they're, you know, feeling kind of like they're outsiders before they've even looked at the painting.
This reminds me of an experience. I was 16 or 17, and at that age, you feel like you don't know anything. I mean, well, you like to think you know certain things, but
you know,
on the other hand, when it comes to things like art and music and stuff, I mean, I was involved with music just as a singer, and I was involved with kind of dabbling with art, but you're just a young person, and there's this huge, grand art world that's populated by all the gods of art and all the people that know things. And I remember I bought a Miles Davis album or two, and I thought these things were cool, but I thought jazz is something that's way beyond me, that I couldn't really understand. And so someday maybe I'll, you know all about jazz and understand, so I don't know. But I liked it. And the thing is now, I have lots of jazz albums. I've listened to jazz for years. And I feel, and I'm also grown up, and I've also seen how all that pantheon of art gods is sort of a bubble that doesn't exist. It's just a bunch of people like ourselves that have grown up and are, you know, running the art world in a way. And although I'm not a musician, so I don't understand necessarily all of the complex structures of jazz music, I feel like I'm somewhat sophisticated in listening.
Yeah.
And I can enjoy one piece over another and just enjoy the world of jazz. So nothing, but I don't know anything more really about it than I did then, except for I've listened to more and I've allowed myself to just be a member of the listening audience of jazz, and I love it. I don't think there was any point at which I understood it. I don't think I understand it any better than I did then.
And you came into it innocently, like you heard it innocently, and I think that can be an advantage. Like I grew up in a family that was not, they weren't really interested in the art scene, modern art, at all. I had no education at home about art. It was something that I was attracted to completely on my own. And as a little girl, if I wanted to learn about art, I went to the library and got the books out and read them myself. My teachers at school, you don't learn that much as a little kid in art class, you know, the kind of things that you do. But I remember visiting museums at the age, my earliest memory in a museum was about the age of 10. And the way that I visit museums now, after being an art major at RISD, studying art history for years and everything, is essentially exactly the same as my way of visiting a museum at the age of 10, which is just like going through and waiting, in a sense, for the painting to draw me and move me in some way. And what I tend to do is write, since I'm more of a writer now, I like to put things into words, and I will write my impressions of the painting. It may have nothing to do with what the intention of the artist was or anything about, you know, my own knowledge, which I have a lot of knowledge of, structure, form, color, you know, whatever. But that doesn't come into play when facing a painting in the museum. It's all what it sparks in me, how it makes me expand, what kind of a catalyst it is for something creative that I might want to do that's an offshoot of that. So I think ignorance in this sense can help you enjoy it.
Well, I used to go to the Metropolitan Museum at all ages in New York, and initially I mean, the first time I went there, obviously I was too young to go by myself. My mother took me, or my aunt or someone, probably my mother. And those days, when you walked into the Met, what you saw first was a pair of knights in armor jousting. They were charging towards each other in full gallop on giant plaster horses with lances. And I remember distinctly that one of the lances was spirally wrapped with a funny kind of prickly red rope-like stuff, and that on its tip there were three nasty little prongs sticking out, and I remember the little holder on the knight's chest that the lance rested in, a little hook sticking out of his armor. And so I went back to the museum to check out the knights, you know, as often as I possibly could. And I would go straight to the armor displays and things like that. And then after a while, of course, I bumped into the Egyptian wing, probably the first time I went there. And I was totally blown away by all the Egyptian stuff, and, you know, all these little statues and little dolls and figurines and, you know, depictions in sort of toy form of, you know, these huge boats on the Nile and the pharaohs going up and down and all this fancy stuff going on, and pictures of pyramids in the background. And spirit doors. I remember they had this stone construct that they had rebuilt from some temple ruins that you actually walked into and then took a turn and walked down another little hallway and then took a turn and walked down another little hallway and came to what looked like a door that was solid stone. And they explained that it was a spirit door of some kind, and that, you know, only gods and goddesses could walk through it, you know. So it was, but that was really phenomenal.
And in that case, that's a case where understanding the association or the story that goes with it is actually kind of an asset.
Made it helps better, you. Yeah.
Makes it better, yeah.
But I almost remember, probably not the first time as an isolated experience, but maybe. When I first decided, I was old enough to go to the museum alone. It was only a block and a half away from our house, and it was considered a very safe distance to walk. But I think I remember the first time I decided to go up that incredibly huge staircase up to the second floor where the paintings began. And I remember, you know, going up there thinking, well, I'm allowed in here, even though I'm just a kid. You know, I was probably 11 or something, I don't know, 10 or 11. And so I walked upstairs, and I knew that the guards always kind of were eyeing me wherever I went, and they were not eyeing everyone else the same way, because I was a little young to be unescorted, you know, and I might do some unspeakable act at any moment. But I turned left and I walked into this gallery room, which is the size of a football field and has probably three rows of paintings on the wall, you know, bumper to bumper all the way around the room. And it just completely blew my mind. I didn't know what to look at. I didn't know why those paintings were there. I had no idea, you know, what made one painting different from another. That here I was surrounded by probably 200 of the finest oil paintings of the last few centuries, and I hadn't a clue what I was looking at. So there was, I was totally naive. And I'd walk around and look at them, mostly trying to figure out why they were in a museum. Why was it so important that this particular painting of, you know, large women and overdressed men, you know, standing on ships or something with complicated skies in the background, and, you know, golden frames a foot thick. Why are they there? What's the big deal? Yes, it's sort of intense, but, you know, the pictures didn't speak to me. And of course, I didn't spend much time because there were hundreds of them, and I had to sort of get an overview of it. So I walked around that room and was just kind of, it was like, you know, reading, you know, Art in America. It was just a random collection of, you know, garish splashes of color that sort of meant nothing. However, as I was leaving the room, I glanced back over my shoulder again, because there was one painting that didn't fit, and it was just blobs. And I hadn't thought much about abstract art. Of course, as it turns out, it wasn't abstract art. It was Seurat. Mm-hmm. But at the far end of the room, I saw this photograph in among the paintings. And I thought, that's funny. And I walked back to it, and as I got closer to it, it turned into a Seurat. And it stopped being a photograph, and it started being a bunch of blobs of paint again. And I remember going backwards and forwards, trying to figure out at what point it stopped being blobs and started being photographic and stuff. And that caught my attention. And then I'd go back just to look at that painting and think about what he was doing and what was going on. And I guess, in a sense, that's what taught me to, you know, bring a different pair of eyeballs with me when I went to look at a painting than, you know, when I went to look at the Knights in Armor. And it probably wasn't, you know, till many years later that I started looking at the armor the same way I was looking at the painting and saw that it was saying something very different from just, you know, you can't hurt me because I'm a knight.
So for every statement that you make about anything, there's an on the other hand. You know, Picasso mm-hmm. tends to make very authoritative sounding statements, you know, and you don't want to contradict them. But as you were talking about your experience in the museum, I realized that much as I love entering a museum with this kind of the innocent eyes that I had when I was 10 years old, at the same time, I absolutely love reading books by scholars like Pierre Schneider, who's like a credible authority on Matisse. Mm-hmm. And he has a book, this enormous book, weighs 8.5 pounds, you know, where he has researched meticulously what Matisse's intention was, where he was, you know, when he painted mm-hmm. each particular painting. And he, as much as he has been able to find out, he's put in this book. And even paintings that have moved me innocently in a museum, when I read those details, scholarly details, they do add another marvelous dimension to my appreciation of that painting. Mm-hmm. Such that the next time I go back and see that painting for real in the museum, there's something even more to it than what I saw innocently.
But still, your experience of the painting is your experience, innocent experience of the painting. If there's beautiful a blue tone against a pink tone or something, that hasn't changed, and it's always been there available to you. Mm-hmm. And if you had spent enough time exploring it, you would start to love that relationship without anyone really pointing it out to you, but books and historical settings and talking of where the artist was at help place the attention. They don't mm-hmm. like suddenly give you the key to understanding. They just place the attention in ways that make you able to go more deeply into it, I believe.
Well, and they also tell you like something about the artist's progression in, you know, like maybe in the book it'll show several drawings that led up to this painting, or even point out that if you look really carefully here, you can see where he painted over this line that used to be here, and then he changed his mind and took it out later on. And so that it's different from understanding the painting as the picture, but to me, the understanding of the artist's method and way of working and, you know, even how long it took.
These enrich your experience.
Yeah, they seem to.
And then we brought up another thing here, and that has to do with historical setting. To be able to enjoy a historical painting, mm-hmm. it's very difficult mm-hmm. to look back and enjoy as someone in the 17th century enjoyed that painting without some preparation and understanding of the states of minds of people in the 17th century. Yeah. And that's a preparation you have to go through to enjoy paintings of the past. And if you can get yourself inside the mind space of the 17th century and then look at that painting, then you go, wow, I see it as they saw it. Mm-hmm. And then it's been brought to life for you. There's a quote of Monet's that I will not be able to utter verbatim, but it goes something like, Everyone talks about understanding my paintings. You don't have to understand my paintings. You only have to love. Hmm. So I think this is what Picasso was getting at,
yes,
in a
right,
way,
yeah.
with his,
yeah.
and all of these things that we've been discussing are the different sort of like ebb and flow of the things that go around enjoying painting. Mm-hmm. But I think painting itself is about love. Creating any kind of works of art or expression have to do about talking about what you love. Mm-hmm. But for there to be communion and communication around the work, which is really the ultimate group encounter around the work, those who come to view the work have to have innocence and mm-hmm. openness and fall in love. You have to allow yourself the room to fall in love.
So that's a good point, because the thing about reading about Matisse, I wouldn't be reading that book about Matisse with all these details unless I already had fallen in love with Matisse's paintings.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if somebody handed me an art book about some artist I'm not attracted to at all, it would be dry tedium.
Right. It's another way to get more of what you liked about the paintings.
Yeah.
And then you fall in love more.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all a big love affair, this art thing.
It is, yeah, totally. Well, it's just why, like, half the quotes by Picasso are about passion and enthusiasm and the fire of creation and all that. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, that's what he's known for, is that vitality in approaching the blank canvas or his studio every day.
Well, I think we should encourage anyone listening to this program. Of course, people I'm about to refer to probably wouldn't be listening to this program, but I just always feel that, you know, there's sort of a popular notion in some circles that, you know, art is just a whole lot of overbearing nonsense, and it doesn't, you know, it's just silly, and people are making too much out of too little. It's easy to understand, you know, where that view comes from, because a lot of art doesn't have any particular depth to it or message to it or anything to contribute. And a lot of art that does doesn't do it in the first couple of seconds that you look at it. And so if you do walk into a gallery and the paintings seem to be just weird and inexplicable, that notion that you brought up in the quote that you read at the beginning of the show about how do you, you know, why do people try to explain paintings? Well, you know, one reason people try to explain paintings is because they're puzzled by them. Mm-hmm. If something is interesting enough to get you puzzled, then that's kind of the first step. And what I would hope is that once someone becomes puzzled by a work of art, that the next step isn't to get an explanation. The next step is just to kind of jump into the puzzlement and get as puzzled as possible. And maybe even have in the back of your mind the notion that the artist needs to be trusted at least long enough to let them get you so puzzled that maybe you'll see something you haven't seen previously.
Yeah, and that puzzlement can crack something open inside you, too. I have loved Kandinsky's paintings for many, many years. And then, like a year or so ago, when I was in the Museum of the Modern Art part of the Pompidou Center in Paris, they had several rooms of Kandinsky's paintings, but they also had this one long hallway of glass cases of his sketchbooks. And the sketchbooks were so puzzling to me. They were so extraordinarily intriguing. It was the ones where he was trying to relate music to form. Mm-hmm. And they were little pencil drawings of like little circles in different relationships. You couldn't figure out at all what he was trying to do in these drawings. And it actually literally made me cry. Mm. I didn't want to leave. And I couldn't go on in the museum that day. I had to just go and be with that feeling, because it opened up something inside me, this like extraordinary longing to not understand intellectually, but to know somehow on a deep level what he felt when he was doing this and how he was progressing through this amazing layering of music and art.
Yeah. Well, I think the artist is opening up something that's universal about all of us. And so it behooves us, when we run into these puzzlements in the museum, to spend a little more time there or investigate a little further. But it's your own duty to go in there to know more about yourself, because he's pointing out, it wouldn't be in that museum to begin with if everyone wasn't somewhat in agreement that this is a wonderful part of human experience that's being explored. And so you want to explore that part of yourself more, and the painting is ticking it off and giving you a direction.
Which I guess gives us a different role for the museum than being simply a shrine. Mm-hmm. It's a window into what people who have looked closely at things have, in this category, you know, have concluded is definitely worth the effort of looking closely again. Mm-hmm. And I must say, you know, there's plenty of stuff out there that, you know, probably isn't worth looking terribly closely at. And it's helpful to have someone, the curator in a sense, who can point you in the right direction and give you a hint about, you know, what has depth to it and won't let you down.
Mm-hmm. And each time you go to the museum, something different can spark you too. And it sometimes can be a surprise. Some painting that you've walked by dozens of times because it just didn't draw you, all of a sudden one day you see something different in that painting, and it moves you in a new way.
Well, museums have definitely been windows into more extraordinary aspects of myself.
Yes.
For sure. Not everybody sees that about museums. Mm.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.